Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Inside Scoop Live, the live audio program brought to you by VitaViews.com. I'm your host, Juanita Watson, and today I'm talking with Lady Sorelli about her new biographical self-help book titled My Journey to Peace with PTSD. Having been a spiritual counselor for over 40 years, Lady Sorelli never dreamed she would walk the same path she had often led her clients on. In her new book, My Journey to Peace with PTSD, she shares how keeping trauma to yourself leads to behavior disorders such as addiction, insomnia, depression, rage, and many other disorders. Lady Sorelli learned how to be at peace with who she was and change those behaviors in order to grow into the individual she wished to be. So today, Lady lives in the mountains of North Carolina, where she helps clients on their own path of healing. She is a craftswoman and fiber artist. She frequently teaches through lectures and workshops and owns and operates her own herb farm. So I'm just so delighted to have Lady on the phone today. This is a very interesting book, an amazing story, and I'm just very interested in hearing more. So welcome to Inside Scoop Live, Lady.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
Yes, great. So before we get started about your book, I'd really like for you to tell us what PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, actually is. I know a lot of our listeners may be familiar with it, but for those who aren't, let's put it out there with a description.
People tend to equate PTSD with war veterans, but in fact, policemen, EMTs, doctors, anybody who deal with life and death situations can be PTSD. And it can be brought on, to me, it's my own definition, is that it stems from a life-threatening incident or trauma that was so difficult or so horrific that the psyche just absolutely turns it off because it's the only way one can handle it. And that's what happened with me 40 years ago.
Mm-hmm. So you weren't actually diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder until later in life. So can you tell us a little bit about how you discovered you actually had it?
In 2003, I had a flashback while in my studio. Well, actually, the Friday before the flashback, I had a very bizarre day. There was no anger. There was no emotions. It was like it was just totally cut off. And I had created a plumbing problem for a very simple job, but I was 9 hours cleaning it up, and I never did finish the job. The 2 days later when I went out to clean up the mess, I went down, bent down to the floor to scrape something off the floor, and that's when the images came through from the flashback from the laundry room, and it went from there on to the rape scene. And what shocked me more than anything was the fact that having been raped violently like I was, I had been slipped in Mickey, and I woke up with the blood all over me and everything, is that my vagina had hurt as though the incident took place in just a few minutes prior to that. It frightened me so bad. It was the only thing in my life that took me to my knees.
Oh, wow. And that was that experience that you were remembering was actually 40 years?
Yes. The rape took place in 63.
That's incredible. Okay, so tell us, you know, your book tells about your story and kind of right from the beginning. So why don't you tell us, you know, how old you were, what the circumstances were with that, and then I know when you were in the Navy, something happened there. So give us an overview of what happened to you.
Well, at the flashback, I was told that there was nothing out there or written that would let me know how and why I came to the point of allowing myself to be victimized so violently. And as a counselor, I had gone back and a few years ago and spoke with Vietnam vets as to why some would come back PTSD and some did not. I found out that those diagnosed PTSD were pre-traumatized in their youth or in their teen life. So I went back and I thought, well, I need to go back to the beginning. And my beginning was having been a victim of incest by my stepfather when I was seven. And my mother found us on the third incident. And it was denied for 40 years. Everybody denied it, kept telling me it was a nightmare. That in itself is where the first anger set in, but I didn't know it to be anger at that time. It wasn't until I'd gone back to the original trauma and came forward, connecting all my life choices, my decisions, and my emotions, and discerning and discovering how, when the came time of the military rape, I was actually had very low self-esteem, like a lot of my clients, and I was in a position where rather than fighting or fleeing, but then at the time I wasn't incapacitated. I just froze, because that was not the only flashback I had. I had two other bad flashbacks, and they had put me into similar situations. And it wasn't until after I had connected everything till I realized that my low self-esteem was similar to a lot to my clients.
Mm-hmm.
So I just, after having connected that, and I became aware where I could change again, I came at peace with who I was, and because there was nothing more I could do about it. I didn't ask for the rape, and society has denigrated sexual assault and rape and incest as something very ugly, and being, you know, feeling bad about it anyway, we just took that on, and no one in their right mind is going to stand up and say, I've been raped, I'm ugly.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I was at, so... That's when I wrote the book, because it's time it came out of the closet and we see it for what it is,
mm-hmm.
not something that needs to be tamped down or made nice for sensitive ears or because we don't want to look at it.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was another question I wanted to ask you, why you actually decided to write this book, if this was more just one more step on your own personal healing process, or if it was because you wanted to get this message out to as many people as possible. You know, what were your thoughts?
When I first came here, I did find someone who did assist me in going back and journaling, which is what I try to get my clients to do, because in journaling, in detail, you actually bring in the very elements that cemented the trauma and making it a very traumatic effort, and it actually reverses it and hopefully turn it into a life experience rather than something so traumatic that it would help to create behavior disorders in adulthood.
Mm-hmm.
When I did this, it was done, you know, like a sequential, and it read like a Johnny One Note type thing. There was nothing to it. I tried writing it the second time from the counselor's point of view, and that didn't work. So after my bypass last year, I sat down for the third time, and I actually owned the story, made it from my perspective. And I was, truthfully, I was kind of impressed the way it came out myself, because
uh-huh.
even then, it was also healing for myself, because it actually did help me to connect and to see where the choices were made and why they were made and based on what.
Mm-hmm.
So writing the book was not only healing for me, but others who have read it thus far have said that it's brought up stuff from their own past, and but they understand now why they have the disorders that they have, like spending too much money or hitting the bottle when they get depressed or eating disorders or road rage. And so if I can put it out there and let people know, you don't have to isolate yourself because you think you're different. In fact, you're not. I would hazard a guess over 50% of our population is PTSD for one reason or another.
Well, I was actually, wondering about that because there seems to be quite a bit of dysfunction. You know, a lot of people are juggling a variety of disorders and issues, from what you're talking about, addictions to depression, anger issues, and I was wondering how many people you feel actually have some sort of early trauma that is still, affecting their lives or being played out.
You can understand the number of the PTSD victims right now because they are the ones that are being diagnosed or brought out. That's not including those who are not aware of their situation or their disorders and where it's coming from to know whether or not they are PTSD. But just from what I can see among behaviors among people, especially the road rage, it is so prevalent out there.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the young people, they are so angry within themselves. They can't even tell you why.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of it's from lack of nurturing and youth. My teenage foster children have taught me that if the love factor is not encased when they are young, they don't really have the courage to go out and explore and to try to expand themselves. And once they understand what that love is, and I teach them how to love themselves or to nurture themselves, it gives them the confidence that it's just unreal, absolutely impressive.
Mm-hmm.
And if you go back and you check with those people who are having road rage or have addictions, you know, they've had traumas in their lives that has not been dealt with immediately after the trauma, or the love factor was absolutely just missing.
Mm-hmm.
So they had to deal with the best they can, and unfortunately the best we can just isn't enough.
Yes. It's interesting because a lot of people just equate post-traumatic stress disorder with maybe the most extreme cases, like, you know, rape or incest or, you know, that kind of thing. But what I hear you saying is just not being brought up in a nurturing environment, or, you know, even, you know, stresses that we may face in the world today can be extremely traumatic, and this all may have an effect on us.
We only need to experience the state of helplessness only one time. Anything that takes place after that connects to that, because it is such a familiar feeling. Any time that we get teased, any time that we get harassed, any time someone hurts us for one reason or another, it's a state of helplessness in which there is no control. We don't have any tools to deal with anything, like if you've been traumatized. And if you've been traumatized once, and there are no tools to nurture yourself, or you don't feel loved, then you tend to freeze. You tend to the lack of self-worth comes in, low self-esteem comes in, and so you don't think you're worthy enough to get up and protect yourself. You think you actually deserve it, which is where a lot of female victims allow themselves to be abused, because
mm-hmm.
they feel they deserve it.
Mm-hmm. And that's an interesting thing, too, because a lot of victims of abuse end up at some point, you know, later on in their life, attracting abusers.
Well, that's because low self-esteem creates rounded shoulders. Women don't necessarily step out. They're continually, I'm so sorry for this, continually starting any statements or comments with "I'm sorry," and also a lot of them have downcast eyes. And these are the elements, whether he is aware of it or not, that an abuser looks for when he sees a victim walk across the street.
Mm-hmm.
If he sees, especially the sloped shoulders, if he sees that, he knows that he can manipulate her.
Mm-hmm.
And it's low self-esteem. Just watch all the sloped shoulders.
So what about depression? What do you feel about depression and the effects of trauma that create depression?
If you've been traumatized, okay, and you create low self-esteem, depression is going to set in because of the chemical imbalance in the brain that takes place. And if the balance stays in long enough, I mean, we all are depressed. I mean, if we stay indoors during the winter time, the lack of vitamin D from the sun will make us depressed. But if you're in an environment to where, you know, you're harassed or there is no love involved, then one becomes depressed because of a chemical, the serotonin is missing. You know, it gets suppressed.
Mm-hmm.
And serotonin is what makes us feel good. And so the chemical imbalance in the brain can keep on. And I've had people who were clinically diagnosed as bipolar, but in fact they were PTSD.
Interesting.
Because it's so because the symptoms are so parallel.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that's a misdiagnosis that happens most of the time?
I don't know about most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
I know with the ones that I've dealt with, they'll come up to me and they'll say, well, you know, I'm bipolar. And I'll get next to them and talk to them for a couple of minutes. I said, you're not bipolar. Because anybody who's bipolar will absolutely zap me of my energy.
Ah.
Okay. And then so then we'll sit down and we'll talk, and I can just listen to their speech. And I said, you're not bipolar, honey. You're PTSD. And then I would ask her a couple of key questions. I would say, well, this happened to you, and I'm willing to bet about this time of your life.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, and there's a pattern. I mean, it's the way it affects people is different, only because we are uniquely different in ourselves because of our life experiences, geography, sociology. But when a trauma, a rape trauma comes in, it will affect basically almost the same each person.
And how is that?
Well, it's just like if someone has been raped, she's going to, sometimes they go into lesbianism. Sometimes they don't go near men at all.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes they get angry enough, they will stay with men just to abuse them.
Mm.
Okay? But because they're trying to let go of that feeling of helplessness. They don't understand what that is. They don't understand how it's affecting them.
Mm-hmm.
A person who is overweight is going to keep eating, okay? Like in my case, I kept eating because I kept losing my babies. Psychologically, I was aborting them, and I didn't realize that, so I was eating to fulfill that.
Hmm.
Plus, too, when I was a child, my mom got depressed, I got fed.
Uh-huh, yeah. Yep.
So it was just, you know, some are habits, lifetime habits that we pick up, but we are not aware of it until we actually go back and look at the life as though it belonged to somebody else, and we can actually say, ah, that's when I decided that, and that's because. So when I sit down and someone sits in front of me and we start talking, and I can always sometimes tell why they're hiding, too, how they're hiding. They don't want to bring it out. They want to, but they're afraid to. And they're afraid to expose themselves. I mean, there's a lot of fear involved.
Oh, absolutely. I think it's so interesting, the process that you're talking about of going back and really looking at choices, because that seems to me like it's an extremely enlightening process, but it also retrains the psyche in a way.
It does, because mm-hmm. if you don't know why you've made your choices, then you don't know what needs to be changed.
Mm-hmm.
And in my going back, I could actually pinpoint why. But if I sat down here and went through a therapist that's chipped away year by year backwards, it would have made absolutely no sense to me.
Mm-hmm.
So I go back to the beginning and I come forward. And I've had clients that I've seen only 3 or 4 times. And then they'll come back a year or two later and they'll say, you know what? You were right. I did such and such, such and such, and you have no idea what it's done.
Wow.
And then sometimes they just take it on their own. And it tickles me.
Yeah.
I've never hung a shingle out, but I've been counseling since I was 21.
You've been counseling for a long time. So tell me a little bit about that, because you were drawn to this profession as a counselor and a spiritual counselor, and it's, you didn't actually go through your own healing process until much later. So do you think that there was,
There was insight there. Like,
yeah.
I was told I had high emotional intelligence, which means I had the ability to look into a situation and see what's actually going on. But the irony of it is I had no clue for myself, which is, I guess, is the way it's supposed to be. But I wasn't drawn to spiritual counseling. It was just always there.
Mm.
It either walked up and knocked on my door or walked into my office or on the street. I remember sitting on a park bench for a 5-minute rest, and I got up 2 hours later. So it was always there. And
wow.
I just thought it was rather curious. Having been the oldest of 10, and never having been given the opportunity to say I couldn't do anything, and never doubting that I could do anything, well, I guess the only thing that allowed me to actually sit down to a person and say, you know what, this is what's wrong, dear, and this is what you've got to do.
Mm-hmm.
And whether or not they do it is up to them. It's
mm-hmm.
their choice, but I just pulled no punches. I never did.
Do you think people have to get to a certain bottom or, have some sort of significant crisis that actually, will spark them to their own healing path? Or what do you see with most of the clients that you do?
When I work with the women, you have to hit bottom.
Mm-hmm.
As long as there is a downward motion or room to go down, you're going to keep going down. When you hit bottom, and this is usually when you've been beaten so badly, you're hospitalized, or your kids have been hurt, or you're so angry that you actually hit bottom and you get ill, it's only then are you able to go into a different direction.
Mm-hmm.
And if someone is not there to help you with there, you'll go right back because you don't know what else to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I have spent the night intuiting, knowing when that point's going to come. And even after working with them, there will come to a point after about 6 months that if someone is not there, they will go back.
Yes.
And I've actually, when I've intuited when that point's going to be coming up, I have actually spent the night.
You've intervened?
Mm-hmm. Well, yes. I get up the next morning and they start talking. And I say, okay, now we talk. We need to discuss this.
Mm-hmm.
And I get a little aggressive and I said, now this is what's happened thus far. And you have to, you need to help them to maintain the anger a little bit to help them through that process. Once they get on the other side, a whole other kind of anger comes in.
I bet.
So that's when I kind of back away and I thought, oh, you know, you have to let them go a little bit because then they realize how, then they see how foolish they feel.
Yeah.
And how simple it could have been when they actually do see what took place and why. Well, then I just step back and let them fly.
And we'll be back with more Inside Scoop Live after these important announcements.
Hi there. Whether you've already written your manuscript or are contemplating writing one, you will need to create a book proposal. ReaderViews has a coaching service to help you create an enticing book proposal for your work of fiction or nonfiction. In fact, ReaderViews will even submit your book proposal to publishers and agents they have created a relationship with, and then they promise to pursue these submissions. Go to ReaderViews.com today and click on Services for Authors to find out more information on book proposals and how ReaderViews can help you.
And now back to Inside Scoop Live with your host, Juanita Watson.
I bet that anger is important to the whole empowerment process.
Once you're angry, it's okay to, you know, if they're angry at the other individual, that passes over, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So you have to kind of keep reminding them of what they've done because their self-esteem is such that they miss the love, they miss the sex. The abusers use sex to manipulate, and they equate it with love. And if they don't get it, then they think they're missing out on love. So I have to retrain what love is, and I teach them how to nurture themselves. I also put them through a little bit of rehab. Because an abuser or victim is usually come from an environment where they themselves have been abused, their sense of humor is different from everybody else, their outlook on life is different, they're not always educated. So you have to retrain them just a little bit to get them in the next level. I don't like using this, but for lack of a better word, the next level of our society where they want to go, to get them out of that alcoholic environment and that mindset. So I sometimes retrain them on some of their behaviors to get them up there with their thinking process. Then I have them maintain that anger. I remind them of that anger. And from the point thus far, from the time I get, you know, when I first start working with them and they are receptive, it will take almost 18 months to 2 years to get them to where they no longer need me.
Is that right? Mm-hmm.
But once it's done, I mean, it's for life.
It's a complete transformation.
They're turned around. They are empowered. And I have to laugh because I actually want to see another abuser come up and try.
Yeah, right.
You know?
Yeah, right.
Because they will not hesitate to kick butt.
Yeah. That must be just incredibly rewarding for you to see that kind of transformation in people.
It was, but it was also very devastating to discover that I was in that same place and didn't realize it.
Yes.
And so I was having, I was fortunate to have had a therapist who was in the program, was the fourth best PTSD program in the country, and she was also the director of a crisis center 17 years prior to that position. And and then of course it's kind of interesting to be, having been a counselor, be sitting on that other side of that chair, because what I had intuited, I was actually experiencing, and it put a whole other twist on the whole process. And so when I wrote the book, and it was rather comical because at the point when I tried to write it from a counselor, my editor come back and make me own it by saying I, me, and you know, rather than you or they.
Mm-hmm.
So it was rather humorous, but I did reach the point to where once, and this is interesting, once the process is done, you can get to the point to where the anger is gone, the pain is gone. And I can honestly sit here and tell you that I love the victims for being human beings. I do not like what they did. I despise what they did. And if they come to my door, I probably, you know, feed them if they're hungry, and if they need a bath, give them a bath, but I will also show them the door back out again.
Yes.
So I've come to that point. And so right now, I'm just lying back and just allowing things to settle, so to speak, after the book. I've been at that for about 4 years. And
I understand that there was a time during the writing process that was extremely fatiguing to you, and I'd like to hear more about that. And then as well as the fatigue that can happen with PTSD and really the body's response to really managing that trauma and that.
To give you a visual, policeman will pull a car over, and by the time he gets out of that car, and the time it takes him to walk to the car that he's pulled over, his adrenal glands are working because he doesn't know what to expect, all right? And then once it's just a simple violation, then he will walk back to his vehicle, and only when he sits down inside or even when the car actually leaves does he really relax. Now, this was related to me by a man who was at the time was undercover. Doctors feel the same way when and EMTs on emergencies, you know, the adrenal gland is working. Now, you work that adrenal gland enough, it's going to create a fatiguing problem. Writing my book and re-experiencing all that stuff over and over, because it had to be edited, had to be gone over. To my knowledge, I've been over it 9 times.
Wow.
And it was fatiguing. I mean, very tiring. And it wasn't until a couple of 3 weeks ago, I've even had it checked out. I mean, my testosterone level increased. It has now decreased with rest and the book being done.
Great.
But I treated myself, which I did about 25 years ago, for fatigue, adrenal fatigue. And I'm sleeping better, and I'm not as fatigued all the time. And the testosterone has gone down. So it could still play on you even writing the book. And right now I'm just resting. I'm just relaxing. I'm taking time for myself for the first time.
Good for you. Good for you. You know, we talked a little bit earlier about the isolation aspect that you often see with victims of abuse, and I'd really like to know a little more about that, about isolation, and then the importance you feel it is for the whole healing process to actually share with other people and to come together with other victims that are going through a healing process.
When society, as I said, denigrates or abases sexual assault, and it doesn't say, you know, you're okay, but the act is awful. They just say sexual assault is ugly, etc. So we take that on, and if we have experienced that, even as a child, I mean, no child has to be sexually assaulted, but we learn through our society to be ashamed of that. And so we take that on, okay? We don't say, well, I didn't ask for it, so this doesn't touch me. You know, because chances are, if it is a trauma, then there was no one there to address it after the fact. So we carry this, and we isolate ourselves with this. We hide ourselves with this. And over a period of time, it will come out in behavior disorders, but we're still hiding it because we think we are the only one it happened to. We hear about it from other people, but then, you know, we're going along with everybody else. You know, they're ugly because they've been raped. So we may not think that, but it's back there in the back of our minds and in our hearts. Once shared, okay, the pain dissipates a little bit, because if it's isolated and it's alone, it's going to gain strength. But if you share it,
okay,
if you share it, it has to break down. It can no longer stand alone. So it's the same thing on the outside, where there is strength in a group or in body. It's the same thing on the inside. If you share that, okay, it's just like if you share your love with somebody, how much everyone else feels good and you feel good. If you share your pain, everyone else feels good because they're helping you. And you feel good because it doesn't hurt as much.
Mm-hmm.
It's out.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to get it out. As long as it stays in, it will gain strength. It will create an anger that is, and the anger itself will get repressed because we can't show our anger. We're not supposed to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And so it gets repressed. And we don't want people to know we're angry because then they'll
right.
ask us why, and then we have to explain. And we don't want to do that. We're ashamed.
Right, right.
And it's so... When I go back into counseling, I want to be able to do it on a group basis. I want these women to understand, to stand up and say, you did not ask for this, okay? You're not have to be ashamed. You are a beautiful soul. You are a beautiful person. And teach them how to love themselves, not to be self-centered, but to nurture themselves.
Mm.
And they will gain courage with that.
Mm-hmm.
And once I get their first step of courage on the path, then they can pretty much take up the speed.
They can go. So what part, I know spirituality is very important to you. What part did spirituality play in your healing process, and how important do you think it is to anybody's healing process?
When I was 4 years old, I didn't realize this until years later. My father, my stepfather, made his first attempt at undressing me, and I didn't realize that at 40 years old was when I started stuttering, which surprised everybody. I was able to speak well up until that point.
Mm-hmm.
And that night, going to bed, I thought I'd gone to sleep, and I was crying because I didn't understand anything. And an angel told me, "Lady, you're beautiful, and you could do whatever you want." From that point on, it never occurred to me to doubt that I could do anything. And people tell me how talented I am and how much I'm able to do, all my abilities. But the fact is, it never occurred to me that I couldn't. I never lost faith in God since then.
Mm.
But I have lost faith in myself because of low self-esteem. And my ability to, the anger that I carried was also my shield. It was my, what I thought was my strength.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a wall that I put up,
mm-hmm.
and it was almost defying anybody to, you know, tap it, break it down.
Yes.
But spirituality in itself, I cannot recall my not being aware of God, but I can recall how many times that I slipped into that darkness when I walked away from God.
That's an interesting point.
Right. So when God was always there, it's just that I wasn't.
Right.
And so when I did get, and of course the universe has got, you know, God's got a way of putting you back on your path very traumatically.
Mm-hmm.
And I had cried my prayers to, I'm part Native American, and I've learned to cry my prayers. And the night that I did cry, I told God, you know, take my darkness, take my dark thoughts, take my pain, take my smoking, take my alcohol, or take me.
Mm.
2 months later, I had an auto accident.
Oh, gosh.
And I should have died. And I had created a party, which I did not want, but was compelled to put one on. And it was my support system after the accident.
Wow.
I did lose my black button of anger. I did lose the alcohol level at the time. I did lose my cigarettes. I smoked 2.5 packs a day, but I haven't had a cigarette since.
Oh, isn't that amazing?
And it's, I should have died. You know, I mean, I had internal injuries, and so.
Sounds like a part of you almost did, you know.
Well, a part did slough off. The anger went away.
Yeah.
You know, I was surprised to discover that I could get angry, but I couldn't hold it beyond the moment.
Mm.
And I was impressed and pleased, but then, see, I didn't have anyone there to tell me what was going on or to say, well, okay, now we need to change this aspect.
Mm-hmm.
So I spent the next 2.5 years trying to get all of what I thought was my memory that lost in that accident. For the first 30 days, I didn't recognize anybody except my husband and the 3 people who visited me.
Wow.
And the few that were in the hospital shortly after. But I had, I got into a period, and then after that 2.5 years, I decided to open up a educational center for children.
Yep.
And I was in a maniacal period of about 6 months. And so my mind getting off me and my problems, I'm discerning, or I'm come to conclusion, is what allowed the flashback to come forward.
Okay.
I relaxed enough to where it came forward. And they will tell you that there is some minute, tiny little memory of something that will trigger that flashback. And I have discovered with some of my clients that it will take a physical sense, like a sight, touch, smell, sound, and taste, to bring back a flashback. It isn't like it just comes out of the middle of nowhere.
Mm-hmm. There's a trigger.
There is a trigger.
Mm-hmm.
And I haven't yet to, I think I know what it is, and I'd rather not share it,
mm-hmm.
but it's the only thing I could think of, and it is minute. Trust me, it was
isn't
so
that
tiny
interesting?
That it was shocking itself.
Yeah, yeah.
But,
no, I understand that at the deepest point of your anger and your depression that you actually discovered through a very profound meditation a specific tool or tools to heal yourself. And now this is something that you're sharing with clients. So I'd like to hear a little bit about that. And then, you know, this tool, this healing modality and your organization.
When I had, after my flashback, I'd looked in the mirror and I had seen this person I did not recognize. I was feeling things that I had never felt in 40 years. My emotions were coming forward, all of them, and I had no idea what to do with them. I couldn't recognize them. And of course, praying for death was not an option. I tried that, and it didn't work.
It didn't work.
And so I'd gone up to above our property, and there was this huge, huge, magnificent oak tree that I'd noticed before but never gave it another thought and was compelled to sit down next to it. When I had... I went into meditation. At that time, I had learned how to meditate and had been doing so for several years. And I had sat down next to that and started crying. And at that point, I hadn't been crying for long because I'd forgotten how. But at that time, I couldn't hold them back. So I just sat there and cried. And I went into, I thought I'd fallen asleep. But I went into a meditative state where in the past I would go towards the light, but this time I did not. I stayed in the darkness, but it was like being enveloped in arms of velvet or something, and there was no light because there was no sight. And there was a throbbing or a resonating of sound that after a while invaded my body, invaded the cells and everything, and then I actually heard the words, "Choke me now."
Mm.
The word says, "Know you are loved," and it carried me.
Mm-hmm.
Carried me through the rest of my healing process. And I also smelled the flower that I experienced years prior when my husband and I had made love outside underneath the apple blossom trees.
Mm.
And the smell or the fragrance was that of exotic perfume and vanilla extract. And that is a gift from the other side.
Beautiful.
So it carries me.
Yes.
And I sign off on my emails with that.
Mm-hmm.
Other people have done so. It makes them think, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's and sometimes they break down.
Mm.
Because it's you know, I'm saying I love you is you know, said in passing and not thought very much. But people stop and you tell them, no, you are loved.
Yes. Yeah, it resonates in a completely different place.
It makes them think. It makes them wonder. It makes them ask. And so that will go with me until I die.
Mm-hmm.
And that is how I sign things off. And that's what I want everyone else to know and to understand. It does not matter. I mean, it matters the trauma you've experienced. But we're not ugly. We are lovely beings created by one entity. It makes us all brothers and sisters. And no matter what choices we have, no matter how ugly life is, the situations that life takes us through, always remember, you are loved.
Just beautiful, beautiful, beautiful thoughts and statement. Lady, what is your website? What is your website so people can find out more about you?
It's peacewithptsd.org.
Okay.
I've created a nonprofit organization, and it's my intention to, we create funds in-house. And we're trying to, and the funds will go towards the community gym that I very much would like to have up and going again. Our community has taken on the old stone schoolhouse and converted it to a center. And I also want to use the funds equally to help women and children get out of violence and into their own homes for the month, and eventually also too, to help school to get them, you know, some form of education that will self-support them. But the site itself and the newsletter that we're hoping will debut in the spring of 2008, I'm hoping to have to, where people can write and say, well, this has happened to me, and have them understand that it is not the only one, and have other groups come up and say, yes, that happened to me as well, too, but you know, this is what I did about it. Mm-hmm. And I also want health professionals to, if they're willing, to share their some of their process and what works and what does not work, and the site can be used by them as well. Anonymity will come in from the victims. I will not share their names. Maybe their states, but that's about it.
Mm-hmm.
But health professionals will be allowed to share their businesses and whatever on the website and a little bit on the newsletter. The website, too, I'm having someone, I think I'm going to be hiring someone else to do the website because I reached a point where I can no longer build on it. But I will have, I have treasures on it right now, and I want to have drop-down menus that indicate what love is.
Mm-hmm.
Which is the very question that all of my foster children have asked me, what is love and how do I know if I'm in love?
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And what is respect and how the two correlate and what is self-love and self-nurturing? You know, have those things on the website.
Wonderful. Wonderful. It's been just such an honor talking with you today, lady. This has just been a fantastic interview. You know, I think that you're just a magnificent woman and you're an incredible healer, and really, this book is, I believe, set to touch many people's hearts, and I just wish you all the success, and thank you for your time, and just want to offer you the last minute to share any final thoughts you'd like to with your listeners today.
People tell me that it took courage to write the book, but it didn't take any more courage to write it than it did to survive the traumas and to live with them. The courage came and is in watching others and helping them, and that's the main reason I stuck myself out there, why I have bored, you know, myself in that book and had people walk the path I walk, feel what I felt, experience what I experienced. It needs to be done to let you know that you're not alone and that little hidden behavior disorders do have a purpose. They do have a reason. There is nothing wrong with you other than you having been traumatized. And you're not ugly. You are beautiful. And you are loved.
Thank you so much, lady.
Thank you, Juanita, for allowing me to share. I appreciate it.
You bet. Anytime. Take care.
You too, dear.
All right. Well, there you go, listeners. What a fantastic interview. This has been Lady Sorelli. The book is My Journey to Peace with PTSD. Check it out. Go to her website, www.peacewithptsd.org. Or check through your local and online booksellers. As well, for more information on Lady Sorelli and her book, you can go to readerviews.com, where you'll find a recent book review and another online interview. So thank you so much for listening to the fantastic program we had for you today. This has been Inside Scoop Live. I'm Juanita Watson, and until next time.